Hello, everyone, and thank you for joining us again on the PCICS podcast, the go-to podcast for pediatric cardiac critical care. I'm Rambod Amirnovine, and I'm joined by my co-host, Jen Gaunt.
Hi, everyone.
This is the second episode in a new sub-series of podcasts that will be focusing on topics related to quality improvement and safety. Today, we are joined by an exciting panel of quality improvement experts to discuss leadership and collaboration in quality improvement. Hello, friends. Can I please ask you to introduce yourselves and tell us a little bit about yourself?
Hello, Rambod. This is Josh Cook. I am the Division Chief of Pediatric Critical Care Medicine and Cardiac Intensive Care Medicine at Phoenix Children's Hospital. And I'm thrilled to be joining you today.
Thank you, Josh. Melissa, can you tell us a little bit about yourself?
Hi, I'm Melissa Winder. I am a critical care nurse practitioner at Primary Children's Hospital in Salt Lake City, and I'm also a quality improvement specialist at Primary Children's, and I have the chance to lead a national collaborative on the study of postoperative chylothorax. I'm excited to be here today.
Kim, tell us a little bit about yourself.
Hi, thank you so much for having me on the podcast. My name is Kim DeMaria, and I am the co-director of quality and safety for the Congenital Heart Center at the University of Michigan Mott Children's Hospital.
Thank you so much, all of you, for joining us.
First, we want to talk a little bit about local leadership and getting QI buy-in. So, Josh, as the director of the Division of Critical Care at a large children's hospital at Phoenix Children's Hospital, what advice do you have about bringing a large team together to collaborate on a project? How do you structure the team? How do you ensure buy-in from those that the project impacts?
Yeah, thanks for that question, Jen. And I realized doing my introductory remarks, I didn't really kind of outline, you know, why I'm here. I think one of the reasons I was asked to be here today is throughout my career, I've had the opportunity to be involved in a lot of different QI projects, and I've had the opportunity to do them very badly and also reasonably well, I would like to think. I think there's a lot of errors that you can make when you're trying to get into quality improvement. And one of the things that I've learned is that when you're trying to bring a large team together, and let's be honest, large teams, any sort of quality improvement project you're performing in a heart center is going to involve a lot of different stakeholders. And one of the early lessons I learned early on was to include all those stakeholders from the get-go. You could have the best idea in the world, and you could have the problem identified, and you could have the key drivers identified and the solution identified, and you could fall flat on your face if you didn't do the front work to kind of involve all the stakeholders, whether that involves nursing, respiratory therapy, whether it involves different physician subspecialties, whether it's cardiologists or surgeons or intensivists. But if you don't involve them and don't give them kind of some voice in how the project is designed, you are likely to fail. And the reason I say that is that you really need kind of local cheerleaders to help your quality improvement project. You have to put the idea forward as to why we need to make this change. It's really important for clinicians that we work with who are really bright and are really data driven. And they need to understand what the problem is and not just feel like you're forcing a new process, you know, 106 of the process they've had to learn today down their throats. And so I think early on, I had these great ideas and I would just try and start them. And I learned pretty quickly that was not going to be very successful. So I think the biggest thing that I would say as far as getting buy-in is getting the individual stakeholders involved early and structure your team and put them on the team so that then they feel an ownership and a part of the project. And that doesn't guarantee success, but I would certainly say it gives you the highest likelihood of success.
Josh, that's one thing I first noticed about you when I met you is that you do such a good job of bringing your team together. I have this memory of you telling me that you do something with your nursing staff. I think you called it donuts and dogs. Tell us a little bit about that and what the real underlying, you know, reason you did that and how it benefited your team.
Yeah, I think that was actually when I first got to Phoenix Children's Hospital, one of the early projects, I guess you would say, it's sort of QI adjacent. I think, you know, we had a real problem with moral distress in the unit, which I think is not uncommon in cardiac intensive care units across the country. We deal with a very sick population. We are doing very cutting edge surgeries and therapies, and there are a lot of children who are quite ill and are in our ICUs for a long time, and that can be really hard on staff, nurses, respiratory therapists, physicians, nurse practitioners. And there was a great deal. We'd had a couple of children who had been in the ICU recently who had long stays, and as I think about sort of different initiatives, you've got to sort of like think of a carrot and kind of why people care and why people, and certainly I need people to kind of address their feelings about moral distress, and we need to kind of get together as a collaborative and talk about it. And so I chose, you know, two things that everybody loves, you know, donuts and dogs. And I engaged our pet therapy department, and then I engaged a healthy amount of donuts to be brought every morning to have to these meetings. And palliative care was involved and nursing administration was involved. And we really just tried to get ahead of some of these issues. And so initially we talked about some of the more problematic cases, but then we really wanted to try and focus on a regularly scheduled meeting to kind of head off issues of moral distress and sort of compassion fatigue and some of the things that happen in our ICUs that I felt like were really important. And so to me, it was worth the investment and the, you know, the pet therapy of people were really, really happy to come and their dogs walk around the, I mean, you can only be so angry when you have a cute little schnauzer snuggling up on your lap. And so we found that to be really effective. I think it's interesting. We also now have a thing called Donuts and Docs, which is more of an educational initiative where a couple of our junior faculty members bring donuts at 6 a.m. and meet in the staff lounge with night nurses who are going off shift and then day nurses coming on to really just talk informally about what's going in the unit and to really kind of, you know, break down some of the barriers so it's not at the bedside, not with kind of a specific patient, but to allow them to ask questions in an informal environment. So I guess if you take away one message from me today, it's to bring donuts and you'll have a higher likelihood of success.
And probably all the people with a sweet tooth will gain a couple of pounds in your unit too, I suspect.
For sure.
that would be me for sure. Well, Josh, a quick question about that second piece. So now it sounds like you have a way of getting not only education, but also feedback from the staff in terms of not just the moral distress piece, but also really more general bedside issues. How can you or how have you used that to try to get feedback on the projects you might be doing in the unit?
Yeah, I remember, I'm glad you asked that because it occurred to me a couple of things. One, it's great to get feedback on how it's going for them to understand. And a lot of times the bedside nurses don't maybe understand the bigger picture of what we're trying to accomplish. And so you can have an avenue just to have a casual conversation about that. The other really useful thing I find is that you find problems and you find ideas that you didn't even know existed. That, you know, the people who are closest to the patients often have the best idea of what's broken in the system. And I've always thought that ideally the best kind of initiators of quality improvement projects are nurse practitioners, because they have a lens that they see the patients in the heart center from that's a little unique, but they understand from the bedside experience what's going on. They understand from provider experience what's going on, and they're able to kind of like sort through, you know, a lot of the kind of hazy things that kind of really we talk about as problems and kind of hone in on what is actually the problem and then sort of think of and initiate, you know, really novel and effective quality improvement solutions. And then they've got buy-in from their colleagues, and then they have an ownership then in the unit that they made this better. And so they love coming to work every day because they've made patient care better on a global scale, beyond just the patients that took care of that day. And so these sort of ideas that come out of nurses' ideas or nurse practitioners' ideas or respiratory therapists or kind of staff, that as physicians, we tend to think that we have kind of all the best ideas. And I would challenge that notion really strongly. I think that's not true. And I think you got to listen to your staff and understand, you know, where the problems are and try and address those, because even fixing little problems can be hugely beneficial to patient care overall.
I think that is so true. There's no problem that is too small to address. I'm curious for the panel, how do you all approach the slow adapters in your group, as well as make those people feel heard? We know within quality improvement, there's different degrees to which people accept change.
I think, first of all, that data will drive the change, and those slow adopters often will come around when you have data to show your intervention or outcomes that may have occurred at other institutions, and then especially what is happening at your own institution with any project that's been implemented. And I think sometimes there is a tendency to judge a project based on past experience, and so being able to talk through some of those situations can be very helpful. And just having an open line of communication, making yourself present, whether that be on the unit or having your email or your phone number available so that people can contact you and kind of address any concerns in real time, we found to be very successful. I think I get, 10 or 12 emails, texts a week on chylothorax and how to address certain patients. And I love it. I think it just means that people are thinking about it and wanting to move a project along.
I completely agree with Melissa about using data to drive change and to get those resistors or late adopters to buy into the project. It's so essential for any quality improvement leader to really know your audience and to understand how and when they prefer to receive data. And it's oftentimes going to vary depending on their discipline. But each discipline needs to understand like why, even the why of the project. Why are we asking them to change their practice? Why are we asking them to make modifications? And it's up to us as the quality improvement leaders to both help them to see their why, but also to create a sense of urgency of why we're asking them to change. I'd also caveat that with the reminder that everyone in your heart center is passionate about improving something. So it could be an order set that bothers them that they have to go in and update something every time. It could be a process like handoff or a procedure cart or something a lot more complex like neuro outcomes or length of stay. But as quality improvement leaders, we have to find ways to align the interests of the team members with a project in order to increase their engagement.
It's pretty clear to me that collaboration is a necessary component of QI research. So to that end, Kim, as a nurse practitioner and as a leader, what are ways in which APPs can help the team collaborate better?
Oh, Jen, that's a great question. I think I would reframe the question a little bit about not so much way that an advanced practitioner can allow teams or help teams to collaborate better, but for any QI leader, regardless of your credentials or the initials after your name. I think that it's important to engage members of your multidisciplinary team. And some of the best ways that I've found to be effective in that is to make sure that there's clear expectations around what engagement in a quality improvement project means, as well as a clear and shared vision. So there's hundreds of different ways that you can be involved in a quality improvement project, whether it's attending, monthly meetings that last for an hour and then being a champion of that project when you're in your clinical practice. Or there's team members that have more time, maybe even protected time, where they can be part of the data collection, the data analysis, writing up the manuscript and so forth. But again, that being said, everyone's passionate about improving something and likely wants to be involved in the project in some way. And so it's about identifying what involvement means to them, what they're capable of dedicating time to, and then supporting them within the realm of their discipline.
Do you think there are challenges specifically related to being an APP in the cardiac ICU in regards to quality improvement? Is there related to schedules that are different than perhaps physicians or nurses' schedules are? And how do you suggest that APPs who are interested in QI get started?
Yeah, I think there's certainly challenges for any of us that want to get involved in quality improvement, whether you're an advanced practitioner or other discipline. And honestly, the biggest barrier is typically just having protected time or time to do it. Quality improvement or being engaged in projects oftentimes means working outside of your scheduled shifts. So whether it's attending a meeting via Zoom or coming in to do project in person, and being willing to kind of go above and beyond what your normal shifts are can be a huge barrier. Oftentimes, as people gain experience with quality improvement, there are sometimes options to get protected time. And I think that being involved in quality improvement, it becomes really important to demonstrate the return on investment of the project, whether it's because you've asked the team to adapt their processes and change. It's important to go back to that team to show them the effectiveness of the change that was made. Or as a quality improvement leader, it's important to sometimes put the dollar signs when possible behind the change. So if you've reduced surgical site infections in your CICU or across your heart center, there's oftentimes dollar signs that you can associate with that. Those are an expensive preventable harm. And so we can prevent that. We oftentimes can show an incredible return on investment in the time that team members have invested both in the change and leading the project.
And when we have QI leaders, division chiefs like Josh, who recognize that the structure of the team is so important and that we have representation from all different groups, I think it can be easier to facilitate APPs who may not have protected time to be able to participate in projects like that when they have leaders who recognize how important that is.
Yep, absolutely. I think I start every project that we launch when we begin to recruit team members, whether it's a nurse practitioner or a dietitian or a physician, by being really clear up front that the engagement is completely dependent on the time that they are willing or able to commit to the project. So being able to attend a meeting and champion the project is sometimes equally as effective and important as being the person who's really driving the project and, again, collecting the data or doing the data analysis of a project. So identifying who's passionate about it, who wants to be part of the change, and then can champion it in their own way in varying amounts of time is key.
And this might be a good opportunity for us to put a plug in for the QI committee of PCICS, where we are a very cohesive group of physicians and APPs to help drive QI education, research, and outreach to all PCICS members. And we're always looking for interested people to join our group, whether that be at the physician end or the APP or bedside nurse end.
Absolutely. I mean, to answer the second half of your question, as a nurse practitioner, or again, anybody that is new to quality improvement and wants to get involved, I would find out who's doing quality within your unit and who's doing quality well. So who's really effective at engaging the teams, getting buy-in and implementing projects that are effective and successful. And I would ask to join any of the projects that are underway. You can learn a lot about both how to make a decision about when change needs to be implemented, about how to effectively implement change, and then the components of data collection, as well as data analysis and making like the run charts and so forth to determine if your change was effective.
Thank you, Kim. Those are some really excellent insights. And I love what you said about both making sure that individuals understand how they can contribute, but also how you can use the outcomes of your project to try to get resources to help those individuals have more protection or more resources. I think that is something that we often forget, is to take our successes to the leadership. And so that was an amazing point. Thank you for bringing that up. This episode is brought to you by Rady Children's Heart Institute. Rady Children's Heart Institute is dedicated to providing the best and most personalized heart care for infants, children, and adults with congenital heart defects or acquired heart disease. The cardiologists and heart surgeons from Rady Children's Specialist San Diego integrate and coordinate research and educational programs to advance knowledge and understanding of pediatric cardiology and heart disease. Our center offers a full range of heart surgery and care and is a major referral center for San Diego, Imperial, Riverside, and Orange counties, as well as the Pacific Rim. Our 30-bed flexacuity cardiothoracic intensive care unit with a core team of intensivists, neonatologists, nurses, advanced practice providers, and other dedicated staff delivers the full spectrum of inpatient and critical care for all patients admitted with congenital or acquired heart disease or complex airway disease, including neonatal care, ECMO, ventricular assist devices, renal replacement therapy, and more. Melissa, I was hoping to change to a little bit of a different topic. You were instrumental in a very successful national collaboration effort, as you mentioned earlier, addressing chylus effusions after patients had their operations. I'm curious, what was the secret sauce that you were so successful in taking what started as a local endeavor and making it a truly impactful national endeavor?
Rambo, the secret sauce is actually Kyle, because who doesn't want to study chylothorax?
I agree with you.
Right? But yeah, my personal bias aside, though, I think there are a couple of things that have gone into actually making this project successful. First of all is the team. I could not have done this without the team that we have. But first of all, with the leadership, it's myself and David Bailey, who's a physician here in Utah as well, that lead the group. And his leadership and mentorship has been really vital in making this work, mostly because he does have a sound background in QI methodology and in guiding the process of this project. And as we know in this group, that QI methodology is sound in identifying pitfalls and the drivers of success and in measuring change over time. So it is important to have at least a leader that can lead out in QI methodology. But then as far as our team was concerned, we really built a multidisciplinary team of people that were truly engaged in the topic. And we definitely learned that engagement outweighed experience, both in QI projects as well as years of clinical experience. And early on, we invited those that had been assigned to participate in the chylothorax work group to please leave, because we only wanted those that were engaged to be involved. And that has really been instrumental. The other thing, and I think Josh spoke nicely to this, but to have our key stakeholders include our multidisciplinary team. We have at least 10% of the chylothorax work group are dietitians, and those, as we're looking to treat chylous effusions, are some of truly our greatest stakeholders, as they're driving the diet and any changes in that regard. And so having this multidisciplinary team of the people that are truly on the ground is very important in keeping the project moving and the engagement in this project.
I just wanted to comment that I wrote this down because I thought this was really an impactful phrase, which is that engagement outweighs experience. And Kim hit on that as well when we were talking just a few minutes ago, that we really want people who are passionate about QI to be able to do QI. And you don't need to be great at QI. You don't need to know all of the rules. You will have people who know the rules, who know how to make run charts, who know what a centerline shift, that are going to help you. But if you're passionate about a topic, if you're passionate about Kyle or something else, then the experience will come along with that. But that passion, that engagement is so key to driving change. And I really liked how you phrased that.
Great. Thank you.
Yeah, I agree so much with that. Actually, it's funny that you mentioned that, Jen, because I was about to say the exact same thing, Melissa. Those words are so key. And I was going to publish it and put it on my wall, honestly, which is, it's true, because, you know, I can't tell you how many times I've had someone who had no experience in QI, but had so much more passion than everybody else on the team, drive the entire project. And it's not just in medicine, right, or in quality. It really is, I think, anywhere, that effort can never be overstated.
Yeah, I was just going to second that. I think it is incredibly important to find ways to align the interests and passions of your team members with a various project, but then to support them along the journey as well. So we talked about how so many team members of various disciplines don't have protected time. And so those of us within quality work who are fortunate enough to have protected time, I feel like that responsibility falls to us, that if I'm working with a physician on a project and they go into their 2 weeks of service and call and so forth, it may fall to me to help get some of our IRB submitted or some of our data collection established, so that when they come back up for air and are ready to rejoin the project, it's continued to move forward while they've been busy with their clinical time and so forth. And then I think it's also very important not just to engage the team members and things that they're passionate about, but for us to be intentional about how to acknowledge and how to recognize their input and their expertise. So different disciplines have different ways of achieving promotion. So physicians need the academic output to be able to promote from assistant to associate professor and so forth. But nurses also typically have a clinical ladder within their institution, and oftentimes so do nurse practitioners or other disciplines. So being clear upfront as you're designing the project, does somebody need a certain role? Do they need to be first author on this? Do they need to be included on the poster so that they can attend the conference? And making sure that you recognize their efforts and oftentimes the time that they put in above and beyond their clinical shifts with the project will help you get oftentimes that engagement for the next project that you'll ask them to participate in.
Thank you, Kim. I'm curious, for any of the panelists, What are things that you have done that you wish you had done differently in your experience as collaborators in quality improvement? Were there some mistakes that you have made that really taught you how to be a better collaborator?
Ramona, I'm going to jump in here really quickly. I mean, I feel like the piece that I've messed up the most often is a piece that I think Kim mentioned earlier is the importance of return on investment and circling back with data to your stakeholders and demonstrating, you know, how the project is going, what improvements we have or haven't seen, what BDSA cycles we've gone through, because I think it can easily get lost in the day-to-day work of the complexity of what we do. And getting back, whether it's quality meetings and knowing how to get in front of your audience, another really important point. And I've messed that up a lot. And projects have died on the vine due to lack of kind of overall. And people are like, are we still even doing that? And I'm like, yeah, I'm putting a lot of effort into it, but I forgot to kind of circle back. And that's something that I really take to heart and try and place an emphasis on now.
I think as a perfectionist myself, I often want things wrapped up with a nice bow before I send them out. And QI has really taught me to just keep things moving. You get the ball rolling and then you start to get people interested in participating. And then a much greater product comes out of it if you just get moving. David will often tell me that a B plus is a passing grade, which it is. But if we start somewhere, then we can actually get it moving faster. And so single center data is better than nothing. And then two centers together is better than one, and just keep going until eventually we have a large multi-center project that is actually demonstrating change. And we've really seen that in chylothorax and with the work group when we're treating a disease process that management has changed very little since the 1950s when it first was rolled out. And so it's been fun to just get started with this and then in the last couple of years be able to really start to drive change just by keeping the project moving.
We've hit on obviously engagement and passion being really important in QI, but I think we want to make sure that we can't sustain projects with just passion. So we have to be able to create systems that keep the projects moving forward and get them into sustain mode. So we don't want to just have one person who is passionate about a project, and then if that person's not there, the project doesn't go anywhere. That passion is great for initiating the projects and for maybe getting them over some humps, but it's really important for us to identify mechanisms to sustain projects so that they continue despite the passionate person not always being at the table.
Jen, that is so well said. And I think that any of us that have started a quality improvement project, I hope, are also thinking about the sustainability of it, right? That the initial inertia that you're going to need to create to drive change within your unit is one aspect of the project, but then building in elements of the change to make sure that it maintains is a whole different skill set, to be honest. And I think one of the important things I tell our teams as we're designing the intervention is that whenever possible, we want to make it easy to do the right thing. So if the intervention is adding 5 extra steps to something or a policy that's hard to find that you want team members to use, I really try to redirect the team to say, again, there's so many conflicting priorities for any of us in our clinical practice that if we are asking teams to go outside of their normal workflows or to add additional steps, it won't be an effective change. We won't get the results either upfront or long term. So I think making it easy to do the right thing will oftentimes build a sustainability into the project. And then you have to think about that constant gardening aspect of quality improvement. So you develop the inertia, you get the change, people are excited about it because you also follow up with them to say, hey, we made these changes and it worked and these are our outcomes now. So being very intentional about circling back with the teams to continue that excitement and buy-in, but then maintaining some amount of constant monitoring of the data, circling back to the teams. But hopefully the intervention was designed well with sustainability in mind from the get-go.
Yeah, I agree with Kim. Keeping things as easy and natural as possible is vital to the success of a project. And then using your outcome measures to drive the variables for data collection, I think are so important so that you can collect the right variables up front and make data collection as easy as possible. And then to use that data to display the outcomes on a regular basis and keep that data in front of the team so that they can continue to see how things are progressing and that transparency can really help with sustainability.
One of the elements of sustainability of a project is knowing when to implement what change. So I cannot stress enough how any unit, regardless of how well staffed or their acuity or so forth, there's only so much change capital that a team or a unit can have. And if we're trying to bring forward 7 different projects, even if they're all important things to do, the unit cannot adapt to all those 7 different changes and projects, and you won't get buy-in. And really, it dilutes the effectiveness of all 7 things you're trying to accomplish. And so as leaders, looking at the data, making decisions about the prioritization of projects, it's so important for us to align with the institutional priorities as well as what the data is showing us and in terms of prioritizing the projects and making sure that we pace out the change in the project so that they're more effective upfront and in the long term.
Melissa, I hear there might be an opportunity at the upcoming TCICS conference for those interested in learning more about quality improvement. Can you tell us a little bit about this?
We are looking forward to a pre-conference workshop at the upcoming PCICS annual meeting in November. It is a quality improvement leadership think tank. So this will be an opportunity to learn more about quality improvement and bring a project that can be developed. And it will be a 1-day pre-conference session this November.
Many of the people who are present on the podcast today will be speakers at that conference. Thank you so much to Josh, Melissa, and Kim for coming on our podcast and discussing leadership, getting buy-in, collaboration across different disciplines, and collaboration across institutions. We've really enjoyed having you guys on our podcast.
Honor to be on this panel and to get to geek out with everybody on quality improvement and outcomes. Thanks so much.
Thank you so much for inviting me to participate today. I learned quite a bit from Melissa and Kim. I found myself wanting to ask more questions than I had answers for. So I always appreciate a discussion like this, and I'm really glad to have been here today. Thanks.
Thanks for your time today. It was fun to be here. And if anyone likes Kyle as much as I do, you know where to come. Thanks so much.
To all of our listeners, thank you for listening to the PCICS podcast. Please don't forget to follow us on Twitter, Facebook, and Instagram. And please subscribe to this podcast on Apple Podcasts, iHeartRadio, or wherever you listen to your podcast. Please visit our website, pcics.org, where you can find more information about how to become a member and enjoy updated information on educational resources, meetings, job listings, and much more. The song, I Don't Know by Grapes, was used under a Creative Commons 3.0 attribution license.